All right, I think it is only fair that I introduce myself. My name is, this one you put in brackets, Pinky. My official one is Yvonne Pompa. I am standing here on behalf of the Standing Committee on Appropriations. And before I proceed, I'm sure you'd also like to know which are those members that I'm standing on their behalf. So I'll ask the members to introduce themselves so that you can see them. It's an opportunity for you to meet the public due to the message that you have sent to Parliament.
Good Father, keep your tongue also from him as I can see this
one.
Hi, this is McKay with Tassie and also the Alpha Family.
Good morning, I'm Rosha Lopesco. She is one of the members of the school.
Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 2018 Appropriation Bill Dialogue. The dialogue serves as a first step in a process to improve public engagement and involvement in budget appropriation, bill consideration, through developing a stronger partnership with stakeholders. Thank you very much. The committee resolved on this approach as we realized that many of our citizens are still not fully participating and engaging in the budget process. Therefore, this will be the best alternative. And thank you for coming. This is going to be a people's appropriation bill. And when it is passed, it will be a people's appropriation bill. Today will give opportunity to stakeholders to make representations and participate in the dialogue, focusing on the deepening public involvement in the consideration of the appropriations bill process. As you know, the appropriations bill was tabled to the House and then referred to the committee for consideration by the committee. But before we finalize, therefore, there's no way we can continue our work without getting a stakeholder involvement in this process. So thank you so much. You are welcome.
Thank you, Jen. In many ways, today is the start of something new in Parliament, hoping that today will bring dialogue on process and content, but also shape the future involvement of the public and interested parties in the budget process in Parliament. Catechism today, although we have a program, it sets up to explore, meaningfully so, the many dynamics that you will bring forward. And to achieve the dialogue for today, you'll see on the program, there's an hour and a bit more, hour and a half, for us to have dialogue after tea. And we look forward that in order for us to set up the condition for that dialogue, we'll have a program where we invite specific stakeholders to make a quick few inputs. We have subject matter experts, which we now seated at the table this morning. They will also give an input, but it's really there to open our minds and to bring us to the process of the sea. So I think let's start with the end in mind. The end in mind is that to collectively have a dialogue where we can talk all of us together this afternoon. And in order to do that, we're going to be very rapid on these inputs. I have the unfortunate task today to take us through that process in sequence and on timing. So I have to deal with the procedure very quickly. We will, first of all, have to discuss a little bit what I call Maslow 1. In other words, there's a water station there. You won't find water on your table. Feel free to help yourself. The back door will remain open. There's a facility in terms of the bathrooms down the stairs to your left. And the tea station is exactly where it'll be. Lunch will be in the restaurant. I won't say that again because I think that's often the way lunch is outside. I think that's basically Maslow and its issues. If you look at in a moment when you start with the proceedings, we start with a 6 minutes. We invite specific presenters here, and you are free to use the podium. We will load the presentation that you provided to us. I'm just checking whether you all have documentation. There should have been an email to you yesterday where you could click and you can download either on your mobile or tablet. And this morning you also made another paper note. I need to say we are avoiding the paper in the future, and that's why the email is there. So we'll put it all in a shared drive that you can access. So I think that takes care of most of the arrangement. I think we're going to jump right into it and invite the representation from the society. I'm Mr. Aaron Hartford. Thank you very much.
That should be taken up, but it can also be responded to effectively if we deal with the There's many examples of corruption and wasteful expenditure, as has been reported by both the Attorney General's office, the Auditor General's office, and many of the reports that come out. We've seen the reports at the moment of 50 billion rand in stolen assets and many wasteful expenditure examples. We've got to ensure that we overhaul the institutions that are meant to respond to that so that we both prosecute and imprison those who are guilty of the corruption in the society to respond to the demands that exist. Then we think that there's a range of areas that the austerity measures that governments introduced that had an impact at the moment. Many of the services delivered, infrastructure plans that have been put in place are not being rolled out because of that. We've seen a number of public service posts being frozen, and then we see that government expenditure is driving economic growth and ensuring that the response to the challenges are not taking place effectively. We don't see that public service get a more pay increase this year, given the support levels that they have across the society, but we haven't seen that with the special offers that are made, and we think that there's an opportunity to do that now in the budgeting process. We've also seen that there continues to be difficulties with management positions increasing in government, but the actual positions that's driving the delivery not. In the various departments, we think that the expenditure patterns that are taking place is not overcoming the challenges that exist. So in healthcare, we're not moving closer to effectively implementing the national health insurance system. In education, we're not closing the gap between the X Model Cs or largely privatized education and what's happening in public education provisions. And then in the policing, we see the continued underinvestment virtually reducing our communities to prisoners in many of the townships of our society. The transport and the crisis in public transport is apparent for everybody and continues to be a nightmare because of other expenditure and corruption within the system. And the departments that we think have got to be responded more effectively to questions related to SASA, both the social grant distribution as it's presently in place, but also the movement to ensure that we're responding to the needs of basic income grants in our society. Agriculture and land reform has not been effectively responded to, and now we see growing protests across the country to make sure that we meet the political ambitions and promises to our people with actual delivery. The issues in the water affairs department is apparent, and we've seen that being reinforced with the disastrous crisis around water within the Western Cape especially. What we'd like to see going forward is to ensure that besides the need to overhaul many of the institutions that men drive delivery, that we deal with the job summit. A job summit must give us the opportunity for meaning engagement so that we both respond to what the job needs are and the requirements to create more employment in our society, but also that we use that as an opportunity to restructure the budgeting process and the fiscal policy completely. We've got to, as a nation, ensure that we close the gap between the rich and the poor, that to respond to the social injury that still exists in our society as a legacy of apartheid, and that we're able to respond to many of the challenges that exist. But this engagement today is an important part of what has always been a call from COSATU for people's budgeting process. We want to ensure that we deepen the engagements that are taking place, that these discussions that are consequence of both the reorientation of those in government and in the state institutions, that brings about effective measures to ensure that the budgetary process responds to the needs of our people. Because unless we bring about a system that builds a more just and equitable society, we're not only going to run the real danger of not living up to the liberation promise of our people, but the growing levels of protest across our society is going to increase and it's going to lead to an implosion in our society. So for COSATU, we think it's absolutely important to be part of these engagements. We value the opportunity to engage with all of our partners in civil society, and we appreciate from government side the creation of this space. We hope that this will lead to meaningful change, because it's 24 years into our democracy, and we're not having a process where people are setting the agenda for expenditure and making sure it responds to the many challenges that exist in our society. We look forward to the outcomes of this conference and continue the engagement of the issues. Thank you very much, Chair.
And my right hand. But I hope everything will go well. Thank you, Chairperson of the Standing Committee, and greetings to all under this roof. Please allow me to say all protocols are set. I am very pleased as a person to have been trusted and sent by my own organization to represent in such a remarkable event. At least for the moment, I feel a sense of ownership and belonging to the processes that are meant to better the lives of my South African citizens. We must also thank the organizers who had our organization in mind as many stakeholders. As one of those citizens who does not have a reason to doubt his citizenship, that report also applies to my comrades and colleagues. I confidently stand before you now, not to convey my own individual feelings in this dialogue, but to try by all means to put on the table the true reflection of what is happening at the justice level. We are here to assist the Standing Committee to see things through an eye of another man in the street, because that is exactly who and what we are. The ordinary South Africans who expect to be respected and listened to. What is also interesting, Chairperson, about this opportunity is that our cities and municipalities do not recognize us. They do not even invite us in these spaces. So often, the municipalities will ask us who the hell we are to even meet them. Now that we have met with you, and everybody in this house will mean a different recognition for all of them. Abakhandwa Kondlondolo movement is a grassroots democratic membership-based social movement of shared dwellers and impoverished people in South Africa. We were formed to fight for, protect, promote, and advance the interests and dignity of shared dwellers and the poor in South Africa. Of course, our head offices are in Durban, in Cape. There is this perception that our movement is just a group of people that encourage people to build sheds everywhere, anywhere. That is very wrong. People live in sheds not just because they enjoy it, they live there out of desperation. And if every economic activity is centralized in big cities and small cities, there shall always be a flow of people from the rural areas into the big cities and the small cities. Our organization is a movement with a vision and a mission. Vision being the movement struggles to build a just and equal society based on dignity and respect for all humankind. Our mission is to improve the lives of the impoverished and marginalized ordinary people living in rural and urban areas, with a special focus on asserting, if not restoring, human dignity for all human beings. As for the benefit of this standing committee, one must give expectations by general landless and homeless. As our slogan says, there must be nothing for us without us. The South African citizen expects that when a public servant stands on the ignition of his or her fancy car to go to work, when he or she opens the door of that air-conditioned public office to sit on that swivel chair, he or she must remember who waited in long queues to vote for them to be there. The ordinary citizens expect you to remember that before we become anything that we all are in life, before we become doctors, mayors, members of parliament, ministers, police officers, teachers, to name a few titles, we are first human beings, so let us all receive and treat each other with dignity and respect. We believe that it must begin there. Abakhandwa Kondlondolo as an organization is ready to avail itself to be of use by positive contributions with regards to the issues of any nature. I wish to point out to you one of the root causes of the countrywide protests. The root cause is that budgets are not spent properly. Monies that are meant to improve the lives of ordinary voting citizens end up in wrong pockets of certain individuals. No living and sane individual member of public may just wake up in the morning and blockade the road with burning objects, risk being tear gassed, shambled, arrested, shot at with rubber bullets, risk injury and even death just for the fun of it. This comes as a result of the accumulated anger where ignorance, when corruption issues are not taken seriously by authorities, when ordinary people are lied to or even taken for granted by the leaders at local government level. At the local sphere of government in this country, in the municipalities, we have a very important number one citizen in the world. And that citizen is a one counselor. This figure is the first individual to interact with the communities, and if anything expected by communities is not properly handled or communicated, we then see violence. Therefore, a lot of focus, we suggest, the monitoring and evaluation must be drawn to the activities of the counselor in the ward, and you will see for yourself how many protests will be there when this is conducted properly. Therefore, as shack dwellers and ordinary citizens, we expect any budget by the state and local government to talk to the following. Land first. The budget, if communicated properly to us, will deal with the security of tenure. This could be in the form of certificates or documents, which will free people from any possible eviction and anxiety. If this is catered for, people will start investing on the land and start looking after their property, and there will be no problems there. Provide service sites for those who may be able to build for themselves. Let us all remember that, even if we may be members of the general public, we are quite aware that we are still law-abiding citizens, and we must contribute meaningfully in the building of this country. We expect that the rollout of internal services such as electricity, road access, refuse collection, and water sanitation while people wait for decent housing. Budget for disaster management, especially for shack fires, floods, etc. We expect that the government, through the budget, must invest in human capacity and public participation, not just for ticking the box, but genuine engagement. Abashalibas and Jodo are not consulted just because we are taken as a people who do not count society. Our authorities do not even respect us. In many instances, it's not just a question of budget constraints, but how we are perceived and treated by the authorities. We are in most cases excluded from the IDP. Only last year, when the ordinary people were invited to a budget, but wait to hear what happened thereafter. In the Siyanda, for instance, that is in Wamashu, there was a pretense that everything was being recorded when the communities were participating in the formulation of the IDP. But a few months later, it was very disappointing that everything that the community has communicated to the authorities never reflected in the document that was supposed to be an IDP. So the question is, what was the point of calling for the public hearings when the community's voice will not be taken seriously? Take, for instance, in Tembisa in Busumut section, in a Buleni municipality, the councillor, Mr. Councillor Silva, in Ward 90, destroyed many homes in what he called reblocking and development. What kind of development that is taken to the people if it will destroy what they think is their homes? And that is used, and that is done through the budget that is from Parliament. Our municipalities are very good at publishing the budgets only when it is time to announce it at public forums, and not when they are being discussed. So often the budget is imposed from above. They should use the same energy of announcing it to actually mobilize us to engage and make an input in it. In Etemini, the Etemini municipality is deliberately excluding our organization and shareholders in general, not only in any housing development but in other benefits, for example, the EPWP, as a form of punishment for our activism against corruption, inequality, and injustice. When time permits, Chairperson, our movement will be more than ready to explain how we think this should be done. Because we are a responsible law-abiding citizen. When we call for the budget to talk to the above items as in the order of priority, we are also mindful that this must be done in a manner that has an element of saving. Thank you, Chairperson, for this rare, very rare opportunity. And we as a movement are looking forward to many meaningful engagements in the future for the sake of peace, development, and prosperity for all deserving and voting citizens in our country, particularly those who live in sheds. Thanks to each and every one of you who took time to listen.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Antonio Nolibran, and I'm the General Secretary of the Social Justice Coalition. The SJC, similar to the previous movement, is also a membership-based social movement that is focused on improving the lives of those predominantly living in informal settlements. And our office is in Kailija. My presentation will follow very similarly to the presentation from other panelists in general, and it's going to focus on answering the first question, which was in the brief that we were given when we invited, which was asking how far does the budget reflect the policy priorities contained in government medium-term strategic framework and the allocation for this year's MTEF. And I want to focus on the outcome 8, which is talking about human settlement in terms of the medium-term strategic framework. And I'm going to read the passage, which is the third paragraph. And just before that, before I go to that, which is something that we need to note and take very seriously, is the issue of spatial injustice, and especially when we talk about land, and in this current land debate, which I and my organization believe at times it's very misplaced, that it doesn't focus on these integral issues when it comes to people's homes and using land for people to live. So this document says that the informal settlement upgrading program will be scaled up, and a more coherent, multi-segmented social rental housing program, which includes backyard rental houses, will be put in place. In addition, the affordable market will be tackled in a more determined fashion with a particular emphasis on a constructive engagement with the private sector to improve delivery. For the success of the planned housing and human settlement program reforms, significant institutional reforms to improve the coordination of housing and human settlement development will be put in place. This includes strengthening major municipalities' capabilities and in particular metropolitan governments to integrate the housing grant, integrate the housing grant and the human settlement making grant more robust, given the accreditation and or assignment of the housing function to the government. This will also be supported by improved interface of the housing and human settlement planning elements with a spatial planning framework driven within as part of government. The guide to guide investment decisions so that they result in more integrated human settlement in turn. This would result in growth in the value of the property market with a more equitable distribution of its benefits. The budget, as we believe, the national budget and the local budget, as we believe, do not reflect this priority and haven't reflected this priority since the medium-term strategic framework was introduced in 2014. What we've been calling for has been that there needs to be a focus on ending apartheid spatial planning. I woke up at 5:30 to be here today because I live in Tanzania, and because I have to be here to make a presentation to Parliament. Majority of poor and working class residents who are keeping this city clean, who are working in this hotel, who are security guards, have to wake up at 4, have to wake up at 5:30 to be here to make sure that the city is running. In that medium-term strategic framework, there was a focus, there was a particular focus on upgrading of informal settlements, which many of our municipalities have neglected. Many of our local government officials and politicians have neglected, because housing, a house is sexier than upgrading an informal settlement. But the focus on housing means that there's still a focus, because when the UISP was introduced, the upgrading informal settlements, upgrading of the informal settlements program, it was introduced so that this focus on eradicating informal settlements would be ended. We will not eradicate informal settlements in the next 30 years, in the next 50 years, and therefore that focus will stop, which is why this, the UISP was introduced. So what we're saying is that the budget must prioritize, especially in the USDG, it must prioritize the upgrading of informal settlements rather than housing. We know politicians are going to go and promise houses, and they're not going to deliver because the backlog is very huge. And the upgrading of informal settlements doesn't mean that someone will not get a house, but it means that while people, the majority, the millions of people are waiting for housing, they live in dignity while they are waiting for houses, which they might get in the next 20, 30, or even to 50 years. And so we're saying that more money must be put towards the USDG, which is focusing on upgrading, more than the HSDG, the housing settlements development grants. And we're also saying that the budget must prioritize land for distant human settlements. Our municipalities, our provincial government, the national government must stop any sale of land. We know what has been happening in the Western Cape with the Tafelberg case in Sea Point, where land is being sold that would house many poor people who would not have to travel these long distances, they're having to wake up at 4 in the morning to be in the CBD. We're saying that well-located land must be unlocked and it must be privatized for housing. This is why I said that sometimes this expropriation without compensation debate is misplaced, because we know there are many pieces of land in the government hands that exist already that do not need to be expropriated. They just need to be prioritized for housing, for social housing, for affordable housing. And we're saying that the government must fast track and budget adequately for the restitution processes. District 6, there have been many promises around that, and nothing has happened, around people being brought back to District 6. And we must be saying that funding for social and affordable housing must be prioritized. But for all of this to happen, we're saying that there needs to be participation from communities. This gathering, this meeting is not proper participation. This is a dialogue for many people who I would call, even myself, are in an elite position, to be in a position to engage with the people that are in this room. Participation means that having to go to the ground and having to explain the budget to someone who lives in an informal setting. What is called the Open Budget Survey, Open Budget Index, that is done by the International Budget Partnership, which rates South Africa in terms of its openness and transparency when it comes to the budget. As much as this is very good and this is impressive, this is only done at the national level. And if you look at the results, we show that in South Africa is rated, out of 102 countries, is rated number 2 in terms of these results. In transparency, South Africa scored 89 out of 100. And in budget oversight, because of the role of Parliament and the role of the Auditor General, South Africa was scored 85 over 100. But if you look at participation, it's very disappointing. 24 out of 100, that's where South Africa was scored. And again, this is only looking at the national level. It's worse at the local government level. And if participation is not prioritized, we are going to continue seeing these headlines in the media. Because being transparent doesn't mean that there's going to be accountability if people are not able to participate in monitoring the budget spending or the budget allocation. Headlines such as 10 million rand is left from the human settlement department while people have been and are going to be protesting for housing, and we have seen 10 million rand taken out of that budget. We see the headline that says South Africa spends much on VIP protection and security as a land reform. We see headlines saying that the VMS fails to spend 540 million rand in mental health support. 135 million rand sale of land by the Western Cape provincial government, land that is supposed to be housing people. And so we're saying without proper participation, without effective, adequate participation for people that are affected, these are the headlines are going to continue. Because transparency on its own is revealing that there's money, and this is where the money is being spent. But participation would try to resolve some of these issues in terms of where that money should be prioritized and how it's spent. Our constitution and legislation is very clear. And section 125 of the constitution is saying one of the objects of local government is to encourage the involvement of local communities and communal organizations in the matters of local government. It further goes that the municipality must structure and manage its budget process to give priorities to the basic needs of the community. Not to the basic needs or to the needs of property developers, to the basic needs of the local communities. And the municipality must encourage and create conditions for local government to participate in the affairs of the municipality, including in the preparation of its budget. We know that when the mayor tables the budget, that budget is created by a few individuals within the municipality. The conditions for the preparation of the budget, for the involvement of people in the preparation of the budget, that is not prioritized. And if national government is going to give grants to municipalities and people are not able to participate in terms of how those grants are prioritized, then we are not going to resolve many of these issues that we are talking about. And to end, this is a case where the budget, the local government budget, was once in South Africa challenged in the Nelson Mandela Bay municipality. And the court there emphasized, and I quote this, in the context of local government, more is required than public meeting and the publication of information. So more is required than setting such a place. A local council is required to put in place mechanisms that create conditions for public participation and that build the capacity of communities to participate. It is required to allocate resources to the task and to ensure that the political and other structures established by the legislation are employed to meet the objectives of effective public participation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. You may wonder why an Afrikaner is here representing South African Women in Dialogue. That's had about 13,000 mostly rural women come to its event since 2003 when it was established. I have the incredible privilege of having been paid to listen to the voices of grassroots women for the last 15 years, and I'm still sitting in the Secretariat of South African Women in Dialogue. And I'm so grateful to have heard all my colleagues speak before me, because it's so clear that we've all been guided to do pretty much the same thing. So I just want to say, from what I've been listening to for the last few years, it's very clear that South African women have already said what the content of Mr. Mandela's reconstruction and development plan of the soul should be. And it's all about public participation from the soul level, through the family, through the community, and trying to pull the resources of government down to the level of the family. So, I mean, obviously Ubuntu is what has created this new country that was able to move from the very unsustainable apartheid legacy that we have. But the South African Women Dialogue since 2003 has shown very clearly that without dialogue and healing and poverty eradication, we can't do what needs to be done. And at the moment, government is not set up to apply budgets directly to the needs of families. And if you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, AU 2063, the NDP, the Medium-Term Strategic Framework, all of them come down to only five categories, which is poverty eradication and economic empowerment, cradle-to-grave education and training. The third one is health, human security, which includes reduction of violence against women. The fourth one is inclusivity, leaving no one behind. And the fifth one is environment and climate change, which could change all the four preceding ones. So we're really living in the most unsustainable time on Earth that humans have been alive, often because of our own decisions. And yet we keep on talking about sustainable development goals when we really are not even about survival status. So when one of my colleagues spoke about disaster management, that really is what we should be looking at. In 2011, South African Women in Dialogue said that their priority for the National Development Plan is a psychosocial, family-based poverty eradication approach combined with productive social alliance and economic empowerment, acceptable, quality, and affordable early childhood education, a strategy to reduce violence against women and children, society coordination, and income generation in all these areas. It's so funny. We pay people to leave their houses and their families and take care of cars, and we don't allocate the same money to people to take care of their own children. So something is very wrong with how we allocate money in our society globally. So what women have brought to the table in the last 15 years is the first priority is poverty, the eradication of inequality, the fact that family incapacitation, which comes from the apartheid era, has left our families so bereft, and the need to professionalize and remunerate the unpaid work of women in sustaining the family and reproducing the human race. We all know hospitals, in order to be efficient, send sick people home so that unpaid women must take care of them. We know that women, because of how we are geared and networked, take care and take the burden of unpaid care for all the youth, the elderly, the sick in our society. Personal and societal healing from apartheid, fatherlessness, stats in AIDS in 2011 already shows that about 68% of children under 5 were growing up in families where fathers were not present. And the levels of sexual violence are in our newspapers every day, from Oscar Pistorius to the incredible violence against women and children. But it's really important that we start looking at how we can budget to change these things. We know that we are now in the seventh year of the African Decade of Women, which is supposed to go from 2010 to 2020. And women are very eager to start implementing what they have come up with in the last 7-8 years. And then the last thing is to have budgets available for the coordination of all activities aimed at empowering women and families. Our founder, has always said women can't eradicate poverty for themselves. They'll still have poor husbands and poor children. So when women talk about poverty eradication and coordination, it's for the whole family. Just to go back to why the world is so unsustainable, for anybody who's been paying attention, what spiritual people, scientists, economists have been saying, we're on the edge of civilizational collapse. We have 5 to 10 years where we can hope that we can undo the effects of all the cumulative decisions we've made so far. But it's very economic injustice is almost impossible to turn around, especially in the light of the environmental situation. I mean, Oxfam has again brought up new things this year. I think that's referred to an older one, but really saying that I think now for the one wealthiest individual in their readjusted, but owes as much wealth as the 3.5 billion of the poorest. Our country is another example of excessive extreme inequality, and we've not been able to fix that. In fact, that almost 70% of children grow up without fathers. I mean, fathers are present, but they're absent in the homes where children grow up. And the domestic violence, which for me is one of the most powerful indicators of what is wrong with our society and how we bring up our own families, domestic violence costs the world 9 times more and kills 9 times more people than all the world's wars taking place in the world today. That's in the 2014 statistic. And that is why we talk about sustainable development goals. The family is the smallest unit of planetary sustainability, and especially in our country, it is the least sustainable. So how do we apply funds to that? Professor Rachel Jukes at a UN Women event last year in November explained the different indicators of interpartner violence and women's experience of it and men's experience of it. It's really interesting when you look at all these things and you think, where are the budgets in our country for stopping the greatest violence in the world? We all talk about peace, but peace has to start with families. And unless you have in a family the ability for children to learn from the example of men and women honorably adjusting their antagonisms, we have no model for going out into the world and honoring our own antagonisms. And this is in all our families. And men and women are opposite species. How do we get that, I want to do everything for free, versus the wonderful, strong sense of provision that many men provide in families? So both men and women can have good and bad qualities. That's one thing that being a Afrikaner taught me, is that the line that divides good and evil goes through the human heart, as Solzhenitsyn said. But when men are not in families, it creates an incredible imbalance. And unfortunately, the level of unemployment makes it almost impossible for men to be provided in families. So there's something that has started from colonialism to apartheid to this deeply unsustainable economic system that the world is working with that needs to be changed if we want to make sure that there's change. This is the example of how men understand interpartner violence, and you see the child emotional violence. They say one of the largest indicators of violence is having witnessed violence, or being a victim, or having witnessed violence in your own family. So knowing that all those things happen, even when they just words, the emotional violence, how do we start healing that and allocating just a budget to it? So what women have said in the last 50 years is you need to focus on the family as a unit of analysis. You need to train and employ family development workers. So we went to Chile and Tunisia. In 2006, we came back, we advocated for a women's ministry, for a planning ministry, we got a women's ministry. And we started piloting. We trained 81 social auxiliary workers. We used Health and Welfare Future Fund. They've now been upskilled by WDB Trust, which also was founded by our founder. And this idea of family development workers, we believe, is the best example of how to start at the bottom and use psychosocial models of paying people to help families become resilient and sustainable. The other thing is small healing dialogue circles. In all, I had a meeting yesterday with somebody who represents the interface, Cape Town Interface Society, and they were saying small dialogue circles are being used everywhere. Professor Swartz from the Human Science Research Council recently brought out a book on everyday restitution, talking about the incredible injustices perpetrated by apartheid in terms of economics, how long white people live, how long people who are not white live in our society, what it would have cost if you had had a house in an area that you lost your house because of apartheid, and what you could have sold it for now. So it's incredibly important that we go back and do the cost of inequality and injustice. And then the other thing is that it's very clear that unless you have a tool that links the voices of communities and families and voices directly to budgets, you can't do what needs to be done. And this is, there's a lot of talk all over the world about the great turning. We are going in a totally unsustainable direction that will end up in civilizational collapse. And for us to move in another direction, we have to start what I guess Mr. Mandela has indicated. The ANC had written a beautiful policy document in 2007, this RDP of the soul that says, care about the individual and whatever it takes to create that individual. So Southeast Development Caravan Model started with a household development where you train young men and women to go into families and make sure that every member of every family has these needs, especially IDs and domestic funds. And then the next one was to facilitate their needs to available existing resources. We didn't quite make it to the community development. So we just spent 3 years in an MOU with CELGA. It was interesting that my colleague also mentioned that even at this very efficient level of local government where there's expertise in sanitation, water, waste management, etc., budgeting, we haven't found a way for communities to really be honest, because at the moment CELGA serves the municipal officials, it does not serve the community. And so how can we as women and as other organizations do the next two levels of community development, the asset identification, the linkages of all the available resources, only once you know what the needs of families are. So I just want to say here, two brilliant tools have come to our attention. One is the poverty stoplight, which I'm sure some of you must have heard of. It really does what Sabi has been doing for the last 9 years, but it very quickly shows you 50 indicators of human development. They're based on Ken Wilber's an American philosopher, but he has something called the integral quadrant that shows you very clearly how the individual and its skills fit into the society and why structures are not at the moment helping individuals. So once you sit with a social worker or a family development worker, they through a smartphone with the family self-diagnoses their well-being, and that is then plotted, and it is plotted on a geomapping of the whole area so that you can see what the needs of everybody in the community is. Here's the social auxiliary workers that we have trained. And then there's a brilliant tool that has come out of Wales. It's a world's best practice. Wales started an act for those internationals called the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. And they designed a system that is called Vocalize. And we talk about democracy, we go in the middle of the knowledge economy, we vote once every 4 years with a pencil. What has happened in Wales is that they've created Vocalize, which allows communities to vote every single minute of every day by saying what their priorities are. So whether it's a state park, something for older people, transport systems, it allows people to say what the priorities in the community are. And you can do it, obviously our spatial wards are spatially apartheid. Here with, well, I live in Seaquest, I'm on the Water Committee, which is totally untransformed. And 98% of the children in Seaquest High don't live in Seaquest. So how do you use a water system when and they can't live there because it's so incredibly expensive? Johannesburg has just shared a draft bill where they're looking at, I mean, very quick. The draft bill says if you build 10 apartments, two of them must be social housing ones for people who earn less than 7,500 who can only pay 2,000. So very clearly, just to say, how do you do what the RDP of the soul requires? It comes from our constitution, and there's a beautiful model around the world called Compassionate Cities. City of Cape Town has started buying into it, but how do you create in all seven spheres of human development from all these ages, from 0 to 6, to cradle to grave, making sure that every need of every person is met? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I usually start with 6 minutes at the back. If I'm here, it starts with 6 minutes. Next on the program, is Business Unity South Africa.
Again, we are here to
parliament in the key portfolio committee, in, I mean, portfolio committee, that are a key stakeholder for the group. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Our last short presentation is by the National Youth Development Agency. Okay, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, here at Bumpa. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Honorable members, honorable chair, my name is Wasim Karim. I represent the National Youth Development Agency. So we are speaking on behalf of young people in South Africa. Program director said short specifically to me, so I'll try and keep within my 6 minutes. Just to give you a sense of what we do, the NYDA is currently the only unitary structure for youth development from a government perspective. If you read the NYDA Act, our mandate is very wide in nature, and we are basically required to respond to all of the challenges faced by young people in South Africa. We receive an annual allocation from National Treasury, and we report to our parent department. Our executive authority is the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. We also do our best to raise funds to the donors, which can support our work for young people. Generally, this is not something you've mentioned, but the NYDA has received 3 consecutive clean audits from the Auditor General, and we have consistently achieved high performance against KPIs in the last 3 financial years. I say this because many of the colleagues, when the NYDA is mentioned, will remember infamous things that happened in 2009, which tend to find its way in every article that's reported about the NYDA, whether it be good or bad. So we are very much committed, Honorable Chair, to spending public money in a fiscal responsible manner. Chairperson, the South African population is a youthful one. Currently, more than 40% of the population is under the age of 35, which represents about 20 million young people in South Africa. Now, South Africa is on the edge of a precipice here, in that we can potentially take ownership of our demographic dividend and use these active young people to boost our economic prospects for the future. In respect of, if you look at the annual budget or the medium-term expenditure framework, government is investing in young people mainly through the education budget. We know that the 2 priorities annually that is always mentioned in the budget is education and health, and this permeates its way through to the provincial budget as well. And obviously this year with the announcement around free higher education, there has been an increased allocation to the higher education budget. Now, we welcome this investment by government into both basic and higher education, but we do believe that education is not the only solution to the challenges faced by young people. The DPME budget mandate paper, and there's no conflict of interest here because we report to the DPME, but DPME, in its budget mandate paper, which is published in 2017, elevated youth development to priority number 2 on the budget. Yet, if you look at the overall budget that was presented by the Minister of Finance, no additional funding has been proposed for youth development. So, Chairperson, there's a famous saying that says there's 3 types of lies. Lies, damned lies, and statistics. But in this case, statistics are very relevant. So, if you look at the latest CSSA report on young people, it says that about 70% of young people are more likely to be victims or perpetrators for that matter of violence, assault, robbery, property theft than adults. Unemployment of young people stands at 60.2%, which includes discouraged work seekers. Youth-headed households stand at 26.1%. Young people without matric is almost at 60%. So these statistics paint a dire picture, and I don't think I need to go through any of these in detail. If you read reports in the media, if you understand the challenges, you will know that this is common knowledge, and often we refer to the ticking time bomb that is young people in South Africa. Chairperson, NYDA's strategy is focused on not duplicating what happens elsewhere in government. So we try and focus activities on specific elements so as to avoid duplication in the public service. So we are very much focused on youth entrepreneurship. If you look at South Africa, we have one of the lowest youth entrepreneurship indexes in the world. The average black child today still believes that to escape poverty, they need to go to school, go to university, and find a job to boost their prospects for the future. Secondly, we focus on jobs, placing young people in available job opportunities and giving them the skills they require to be active citizens in the economy. Thirdly, we focus on national youth service, which I'll speak about a little bit later. And lastly, many of the speakers today have alluded to the fact that access is a major impact on what's driving unemployment in this country. So even if you look at government services today, they still reflect apartheid spatial planning. And therefore, for that instance, NYDA's offices or its service delivery channels are located in mainly metropolitan areas. So we have a specific focus on taking our services through collaboration with local municipalities, with provincial government, to avoid spending money on bricks and mortar, to taking our services to districts and to rural areas where they are most required by young people, by those young people most affected by the social challenges. Supporting our strategy, we still try and mainstream youth development to work with private sector partners, public sector partners, civil society, to make sure that youth development is mainstream in society. Lastly, we want to be thought leaders on youth development. So we want to be advocates of young people in society. And we're also focusing on the integrated youth development strategy, which focuses through our parent department, DPME, on monitoring government activity across youth development. So focusing on what health is doing, focusing on the outcomes in education, focusing on social development, and calling departments out where they are not meeting their outcomes as related to youth development. That's just a breakdown of our budget. Often you hear that NYDA is allocated funding, it's a waste of taxpayers' money, but a budget allocation of about 450 million rand can only go so far in addressing the challenges of 20 million young people in society. There's just a trajectory of what our budget has been since our inception in 2010. It's grown from about 369 million to about 447 million. You'll see the years where they were physical cuts. We were also affected by those physical cuts. Chairperson, our recommendations to the Standing Committee are as follows. The National Development Plan refers to the creation of small, micro, and medium enterprises, which will be responsible for the creation of 90% of the jobs in the economy. Now, the NYDA, through our grant funding program, so we took a decision to move away from loan financing because we did not want to burden young people at a young age with massive repayments. So we took a decision to stimulate entrepreneurship in this country amongst young people to introduce an innovative grant program. Over the last 3 years, we've been able to fund over 2,500 startup and survivalist businesses. And we've been able to create more than 10,000 jobs for those young people. But the NYDA remains the only institution from which young people can obtain funding for entrepreneurship. And even in that, our funding goes up to a maximum of 200,000 rand per business. Currently, we invest about 42 million rand in our grant funding and about 73 million rand in economic development. But we're merely scratching the surface of youth entrepreneurship policy. If you look at how the financial services sector operates, commercial banks are unlikely to fund startups. The developmental finance institutions in this country still have very stringent lending criteria, which means young people potentially can't access it. So we are recommending, Chairperson, that the government establishes a youth fund that can cut across youth entrepreneurship. The NYDA possesses the skills and infrastructure to roll out a massive program of this scale and magnitude. And we believe that this will go beyond just speaking a narrative and beyond just stimulating entrepreneurship. to really driving the goals of the National Development Plan and driving job creation on a large scale basis. Our second recommendation, Chairperson, is that there are various initiatives in South Africa which are focused on placing young people in available job opportunities. I'm sure many of you know of Karambi, which is the Youth Employment Accelerator, which receives a multitude of funding from the Jobs Fund. The President also announced in the State of the Nation the launch of the Youth Employment Service, which will aim to place 1 million young people in job opportunities which are 12 months or longer. We very much welcome these initiatives, and we believe that they are contributing to the development of young people and addressing the crisis that is youth unemployment. But, Chairperson, we want to advocate for a fact that many young people out there are not unemployed, but they are unemployable, which means they do not have verifiable skills to offer to the economy. We need to focus on a skills revolution in the country, and that is creating the skills that the economy needs and preparing ourselves for the fourth industrial revolution. Now, if you look at skills development funding in this country, it's mainly driven through two elements. One is TVET colleges, and the other one is sector education training authorities. Chairperson, we believe there is not sufficient oversight over how these skill development allocations are being focused towards young people. And we believe that the budget needs to be looked at from a perspective of creating skills development funding for specifically for young people out there. We believe that this can be done through a public-private partnership whereby these young people are placed in apprenticeships once they have completed their training or in collaboration with their training. My second last point, you'll remember that I referred that the NYDA runs National Youth Service Program. Now, I believe strongly that in the conversation around economic growth in the country, we must not forget that we face challenges around social cohesion, around patriotism, and around nation building. We have a generation of young people who we don't want to be lost to the system. Therefore, in the conversation around economic growth, we hold a view that with the implementation of E3 higher education, with services provided to young people around skills development training, should be enhanced through a compulsory national youth service program. Young people need to build a culture of volunteerism in their communities, in the public service, and in civil society. In this way, we will build a culture and a cohort of a future generation of young leaders. Chairperson, my last point, and this I speak more at a broad level. Many of the colleagues have alluded to the challenges in government around irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, around government departments not meeting their outcomes as envisaged in the annual performance plan. We advocate strongly that the budget appropriation must be linked to financial prudence and to performance of government departments. If you're not performing, why are you being allocated additional funds? In addition, Chairperson, we can submit detailed business cases based on the figures that we've alluded to above and based on the targets that we believe we can achieve through additional funding that can be provided. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That concludes our rapid presentation. We are now going for the subject matter report. But before that, would you please take some time to stand and meet the person on the left. They are very impressive stakeholders here today. And please admit that we are here to have a dialogue. And then I'm going to allow just for 2 minutes, quickly for a comfort break before we take the longer one. There's some more water, things that are outside of the meter. You don't need to go. Please greet the person on the left. It's always nice to know. Thank you very much.
brengt, dus. Wat hij brengt, dus.